We're going to be talking about radiation therapy for prostate cancer in general, and then we're going to talk about why CyberKnife seems to be the next big thing, even though it's been around for about 9 or 10 years. But I think more and more patients are becoming savvy to considering CyberKnife, analogous perhaps to the Da Vinci robotic surgery that many newly diagnosed prostate cancer patients use. So, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and very grateful for you to be here. Let's get into this.
Sure.
First, let's get into what is radiation.
Radiation is high energy X-rays. So you're depositing energy into a target. And by doing that with the latest technology, you're able to kill off a tumor and you're able to preferentially address a given region and to spare the adjacent tissues around that region. Mm-hmm. That would be my summary of sort of what radiation is. It's a broad question because there are different types of radiation, mm-hmm. but in a therapeutic sense, the type of radiation that we give as radiation oncologists is essentially high dose energy that gets delivered to ablate and kill off tumors.
Okay, so the kill off part. Mm-hmm. What are we killing? How are we killing something?
So the mechanism, the way that the radiation's working in the classical way, the way that was studied in the 1970s, 1950s, is that it's damaging the DNA of a cancer cell. Mm-hmm. And so when cancer cells try to divide, they die off after having radiation. Mm-hmm. There are theories, and you could really delve into this, and there are people who have entire careers devoted to what's called radiation biology, where they ask questions, do larger doses have a different mechanism of action? But essentially the way radiation works in sort of our modern conception of it, mm-hmm. is that it's killing off the cancer cells through damaging their DNA.
And damaging DNA does what?
When cancer cells try to divide, which is all that cancer cells do, they essentially die off.
But so I think like a common thought around cancer cells is that cancer cells divide and continue to divide because the DNA within them is different.
Sure. The DNA is mutated. Hmm. So our cells, we have cancer cells throughout our lifetimes, and our body has a pre-programmed way of killing off abnormal cells. Mm-hmm. The cancer cell is the cell that got away. The body did not realize it was abnormal. Mm-hmm. And that particular cell continued to divide and continued to divide. So the normal process of the body saying this cell's not behaving the way it should, sort of it fell through the cracks. The damage that the radiation performs on the cancer cell DNA is what's called double-stranded DNA breaks. It's a fancy way of saying the damage renders that cancer cell unable to continue to divide. Mm. And when it tries to, it dies off. Again, the fancy sort of ways of talking about it, mm. the classical way was mitotic catastrophe, which is a very dramatic way of characterizing it. But essentially, the cancer cells are dying off, and the normal tissue is healing itself in between each of the treatments.
So, but it's not possible for the cancer cell to heal itself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Not with the doses we're given.
Okay.
So again, this is radiation's been around for well over 100 years, and our ability, it's not a binary thing where you turn on a sort of a switch and then there's radiation. You're able to really modulate. You're able to really paint the doses and determine what doses to give and to what areas that you're delivering it with such accuracy. You're able to give the appropriate dose for the appropriate cancer. Not every cancer requires the same dose, and not every normal tissue repairs the same way. So really, radiation oncologists, we are practitioners, as you had asked, but we're clinical oncologists. We have to memorize what doses every single structure in the body can tolerate, what percentage of whatever structure can tolerate with each dose, and that goes part into the training of being a radiation oncologist.
So different bodies would take different, like a skinny guy versus
no,
a fat guy?
No, different structures. So the tolerance of the rectum is different than the tolerance of the bladder. The tolerance of nerves is different than the tolerance of brain tissue. Mm-hmm. So every structure of our body has a different amount of radiation it can receive and repair itself when it receives from one another, but not usually not between individuals.
Not to get too deep into med school stuff, but what is the difference? What is the quality of difference? For example, is the DNA of a bladder different than the DNA of bladder cells different than prostate cells?
It's not about the each of our structures has a different ability. Each of the organs and systems that we have in our body have a different ability to repair itself when it's faced with what's called ionizing radiation, just high energy. Hmm. Cancer cells have damage to their DNA. Normal tissue, it repairs. You regenerate, you replenish normal tissue. Hmm. There are a lot of mechanisms of the body that constantly think about when you have a burn. When you go outside, you have a burn. You don't stay with that burn forever. Your body heals itself. Think about when you have a cut. Your body heals itself. Hmm. If the cut is too big, you need to have stitches. It's sort of the same sort of analogy that you would give with radiation toxicity or radiation healing. There's a certain dose at which your body will be able to heal. Mm-hmm. And that's really the job of the radiation oncologist to really, like a skilled technician, paint the doses just so to allow your body to heal while the cancer gets cured.
So there are people who are watching this who have gone through radiation therapy perhaps years ago and are thinking to themselves, but I have a second cancer now. Didn't my radiation therapy cause that?
Sure. It's a great question. So there's a whole field devoted to what's called secondary malignancies. So people essentially looking at data and saying, what's the chance that somebody who is exposed to radiation now has a subsequent cancer later on in their life? The chance of that is a statistical one, meaning that there's no large study out there where people are followed for hundreds of months. What people have done is they've looked at young women who had breast cancer in the 1960s and had these large fields of radiation that were delivered back then. These are called mantle fields. And then they looked at them later on and said, well, what was the chance of them developing breast cancer? And there are large populations, large databases where you can start measuring these. In general, the dose of a radiation-induced secondary cancer is extraordinarily low. So when I counsel men, and it usually takes 20 years, 15 years, maybe 10 years at the earliest to even see. So when I counsel men on the rate of a radiation-induced malignancy, I'll tell them 1 out of 10,000, 1 out of 100,000, such that the risk of having prostate cancer, it's the number one cause of cancer in men, I'll tell that man, well, colorectal cancer is the number three cause of cancer in men. Bladder cancer is number four. Just because you have one cancer doesn't mean you can't have a subsequent cancer. I will tell you, I'm very thorough when I treat patients. I get images of them before I ever treat them. I want to have a good idea of what their prostate looks like and the cancer itself looks like. And there are non-insignificant number of times I find incidental other malignancies.
Yeah.
So to your question, if those men had been treated in the 1980s, before we ever had the sophistication of the images, that man would have developed symptoms and somebody could have easily said it was the radiation that caused that secondary cancer.
Yeah.
Whereas now I'm telling you, incidentally, any oncologist, whether a surgeon, radiation, or medical oncologist, we see incidental secondary cancers all the time.
So, and I can tell you, like, from the last 3 or 4 years, we have a number of guys, not necessarily in our New York group, but in some of the groups in the Midwest that the group leaders there from Male Care have reported back. Bladder cancer has been discovered as a consequence of prostate cancer, and for those guys, bladder cancer was the more acute issue, you know, at least for those particular profiles of those particular guys. The idea, though, that it's not just the therapy, it's you're also, patients have to go through CAT scans, they have to go through bone scan, you know, a lot of radiological and radiation-inducing scanning and things.
Sure.
All that combined, wouldn't that in itself, I guess the better question is, does radiation provoke a new cancer?
The radiation delivered to hundreds of millions of people will cause cancer in a very low number of people. So with that said, when you have a child, you try not to expose them to radiation. When you have any human being, you don't expose them to even a drop of radiation if they don't need it. Once somebody has a diagnosis of cancer, you're trying to cure them of their disease, prevent metastatic disease, let them live the rest of their lives. For that individual, not exposing them to the necessary tests to really accurately know where their tumor is essentially is much worse than the microscopic, minute chance that you may induce a secondary malignancy 20 years later.
Yeah.
So really, you're talking the issue at play, and we see really smart people who ask very thoughtful questions like this, is what's dangerous to an individual versus what is dangerous to a population? Exposing a population, hundreds of millions of people, to radiation needlessly will cause cancer in a very small number of people. For people who already have that diagnosis, to better assess what the cancer status is, you have to expose them. But the exposure they're getting is such a trivial thing. It's not something that we really, it's something I talk to patients about clearly, but it's not something that I would ever avoid.
Is there a number of CAT scans that you could tell us would be the upper limit for a normal human being to have?
So these are things that people do study. They're usually radiation biologists. And part of the reason I can't give you a specific number of CAT scans is because the dose of radiation that's being delivered by CAT scans keeps getting less and less. So as our technology gets better, we're able to do very low dose radiation imaging. But that'd be very appropriate for a radiologist or, you know, people who utilize these tests. It's something that gets measured. But again, it's a concept that I often feel that very smart people it's challenging for them sometimes to navigate, because the issue at play is not, do I want to take a group of 10-year-olds and start getting CAT scans of their heads for fun and expose them needlessly to radiation? The issue at hand is, I know somebody has a cancer. I really have to know if what the status of that cancer is. I need to aim some therapy, whether it's surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And in that context, when I say necessary evil, I think even the word evil would imply the negatives are that high. Mm-hmm. It's something that is measurable in only calculated sort of methods. Mm-hmm. Meaning that the number of people who end up having secondary malignancies from radiation is extraordinarily low.
Yeah. I mean, not to grind this into the ground, so to speak, but, you know, prostate cancer dies typically 50, 60, 70 years old. They're also dealing with cardiac surveillance, you know, so they have radiological dyes.
They take airplanes.
Yeah.
They're exposed to radiation by being in the air.
Sure.
You and I are exposed to radiation by walking outside. We're ionizing radiation from the sun.
Which raises, you know, should people fly less? We should live our lives and be happy, but it's only been in the last, you know, two or three decades that people have had these extraordinary environmental exposures that probably are benign, you know, I'm on the same page with you. I mean, better to find out,
sure,
useful and all that. But there are people watching this, and I sort of bought into this years ago, you know, that what if, you know, I mean, what, maybe I shouldn't fly 3 times a week or something, you know?
Well, somebody could turn around and say you're exposed to radiation in other ways, not to drive you mad,
yeah,
but you eat a banana. There's some trace amounts of radioactivity,
yeah,
in the potassium. We are surrounded by a world that has radiation. Most of it is not ionizing, which is capable of damaging normal cells, but a lot of it is. And I think the guiding principle, sort of the northern star are, so to speak, that most people who administer a test or a therapy, they'll use a concept called ALARA. So as low as reasonably attainable or achievable. Mm-hmm. So you really want to be judicious with doing it. Nobody ever orders a scan lightly, or they shouldn't. Yeah. Nobody ever gives a treatment lightly, or they shouldn't. But in every single case, when you're doing it for a good reason, and the damage that you'd be causing is so far outweighed by the benefit you're providing, yeah. It goes into the category usually of something that doesn't even truly get discussed often.
Yeah, I mean, you need information, you need understanding before you make a treatment choice.
Sure.
And diagnostic tools like scans are one of the ways to find that information.
It's essential. So let's talk about the case of a really smart person who I see who says to me, I will not get a CAT scan. Mm. Right? So that person is putting their life in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. So think about the irony. For the one in X million chance that the CAT scan would expose me to a cancer 20 years from now, I will not have the therapy I need to cure me of the disease that I already know I have.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a psychological sort of problem when you're dealing with a reasonable person. Most people would, I think, make a decision based on health and reason for them.
Sure. You use the term radiologist, radiation oncologist. There are also medical physicists and such. What are all these people?
It's a good question. So if you ask my mother what I do for a living, my mother will tell you I'm a radiologist oncologist. Radiation oncology has nothing to do with radiology. So it's a way of thinking. It's like your orthopedic surgeon has nothing to do with being an orthodontist. They sound similar, nothing related. So a radiation oncologist is a cancer doctor who studies how to deliver radiation to cure cancer. So that's really what a radiation oncologist is. Mm-hmm. There are other ways of curing cancer. You could cure cancer with chemotherapy, so that's a medical oncologist. Mm-hmm. And you could cure cancer with surgery, so that's a surgical oncologist. And those are the three types of oncologists that are out there. Mm-hmm. In order to use radiation, we work with superstars. We work with PhD and master's level medical physicists. People who have exquisite training, they're able to help us with the machines, they're able to help us develop the plans. I will tell you, I married a medical physicist, so we talk shop quite a bit, but they're very smart people who are, it's unique, but they work in the field of radiation oncology.
Good. Let's get into a bit of what you actually do.
Sure.
And let's transition by me asking you, what's new and great in radiation therapy?
That's a great question. What's new and great is as our precision is getting better and better, so the machines like the CyberKnife, the unit that we have, we're able to test the doses a little bit better. We're able to raise the doses a little bit. We're able to study the interaction with other substances. So can you give radiation with other agents that may make radiation more effective? Can you treat different areas? Can you take people who have metastatic disease and essentially let them die with and not from their cancer? Mm-hmm. All of that is fascinating, and it's really, for people like me, it's a page turner. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we read about in every single month, every new journal.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I have hundreds, if not 38 questions that people have emailed in. So we'll get into that a bit. Actually, would you mind sitting a little closer so
sure.
that people get both of your shoulders, I guess. This is Seth Blacksburg, doctor of radiation oncology. Why don't you tell us all, like in 5 minutes or less, or 3 minutes or less, what is CyberKnife? What is that about?
So, well, let me sort of give it, I'll characterize radiation in general. So in general, radiation is delivered through radioactive materials like seeds, so seed implant, radioactive catheters, or on these large machines called linear accelerators. The old way of delivering radiation with these linear accelerators is you'd have a beam go through one side of the body and it comes out the other side. And the beam goes through another side of the body, goes out through the other side. Starting in the 1990s, you had a technology really that was all computerized, which was called IMRT, intensity modulated radiation. All that means it's this modern day radiation that's fueled by computers, where the beams of radiation don't just go in you and out you with just very few beams. You could generate hundreds of beams, seven beams, as many as you want to really shape the radiation very precisely. The CyberKnife is sort of the end of that evolutionary tree. It's a radiation machine that's been miniaturized and it's been put on a robotic arm. And so with that radiation, it's able to do two things extraordinarily uniquely. One of the advantages is since it's on a robotic arm, the beams of radiation don't move like a record player in an arc trajectory around the body. Instead, on a robotic arm, you come from hundreds of different angles. So as infinite number of angles and directions, you could aim the radiation. As a result of that, that's called non-coplanar treatment. You could dial the radiation to a much tighter area, so much more precisely delivered. The parts at the edge of that area still see high dose, but as you move away from that little cocoon, that little shell of radiation that's being delivered wherever you're delivering it to in the body, the dose falls off rapidly. So that's a major innovation, and you're really exposing a lower volume of normal tissue to the treatment.
So I hear two things. One, the robot part of it. I mean, the miniature linear accelerator. And linear accelerator, that's the correct
term? It's just the machine. Linear accelerator is what delivers the radiation.
Okay. And linear acceleration is just...
You're accelerating. It gets into the physics of how it works. You're accelerating an electron that essentially will generate a high-energy X-ray.
Okay. So... the robotic arm versus the IMR, the external beam that many people are familiar with. The external beam thing moves around.
It has a fixed arm called a gantry. It's a large machine with this fixed arm. Mm-hmm. It could only spin around like a record player.
Okay. So the robotic arm that you're talking about, and I wish we had pictures or a model. I wish we had an operating model of this. What a great a Lego tool.
Sure. Well, think about your hand and your arm. Right. Think about if you're able to move.
I'm the prostate.
If you're able to bend your elbow and flex your wrist and move your fingers, that's what the machine's able to do. It's able to come in whatever direction it needs
right.
to.
Think of what films that we've seen of like Ford or Toyota or car manufacturers, the robots that paint those cars.
That's right.
Right.
And that is the robot. It's the KUKA robot.
Yeah.
That is the robot.
And you know, that sounds almost like, you know, like, my God, I'm going to be treated by a car, you know, or by, you know, by Toyota, you know, I mean, but think of this, my friends, think of this, this robot, how do you pronounce it? KUKA?
It's the KUKA robot.
KUKA, yeah. I mean, that's been around for at least 25
sure.
years, and it's been perfected and gone through an insane number of versions, and the software that controls it has been refined and refined. That thing is like the most accurate deliverer of paint or anything like paint on the planet. And every 5 minutes it gets better because it's in the interest of manufacturer to please Toyota and Ford and all of the other car manufacturers and all the other of their customers to make it better and better and better because competition is nicking at their heels. But this is like a brilliant device. And to sure. use it for delivering, you know, radiation therapy is just, I mean, what a marvel. Whoever thought to.
So it was neurosurgeon
yeah.
at Stanford University named John Adler, and he trained with a famous neurosurgeon from Scandinavia who had developed a machine called a gamma knife, where you put people in this metal halo that had radioactive ports in it, and it could very precisely treat an area.
Uh-huh.
This neurosurgeon is a brilliant gentleman who developed developed the concept and said the radiation oncologists are doing it all wrong. I found a better way of using the gamma knife. And instead of screwing people's skulls into this rigid body and having naturally radioactive materials that are placed into the ports, instead, I don't need to screw somebody's skull into sort of a frame. I'm able to develop a machine that will watch as the skull's moving, and it could deliver radiation on the robotic platform.
Okay.
And that was the innovation.
It's brilliant. So there are two aspects of this that really just jazz me up, is the idea of precision and of dosing. Let's talk about precision a bit.
Sure.
A person sits on a bed, you know, in the radiation theater. What do you call the room?
The vault.
Oh, that's
it's technically
scary.
A vault. It's okay. Lead-lined walls, yeah. But it's just the room. You don't even know it's a vault.
Okay,
it's just a room.
So there's lead on the floor as well.
Yes. Wow. You've lead all around just to prevent any leakage of radiation.
So Superman would be okay, I guess. I don't know if lead prevents kryptonite.
Yeah, there's no kryptonite.
No. Okay. So the idea of okay, so you're laying down, but I mean you're breathing, your body's moving. I mean we all know. How does the machine? I mean I know the answer to this. I want to ask the question in a clever way, but I'll just ask it in a simple way. How does the machine track the prostate and make sure it doesn't hit on something else?
So when I was talking about the CyberKnife, I was saying there's two innovations. The first innovation is the non-coplanar, so the aspect of coming from so many different angles where you can pack the dose of radiation very tightly. That's extraordinarily important, because when you're thinking about treating prostate cancer and you're trying to limit dose to the testicles or to the base of the penis or to the bladder, to the rectum, that being able to pack that dose together is extremely important, and we can measure very clearly the benefits of using that technology. That's the map. What we know is the map doesn't always match the territory. Mm-hmm. So right now, my heart is moving, and my liver is moving, and my lungs are moving. If you staple me to the wall, well, all those structures are still moving inside of my body. Mm-hmm. When prostate cancer has traditionally been treated, so when you talk about IMRT, or the computerized radiation, people are lying down. The machine is able to see the target before treatment, but not during treatment. The other innovation of the CyberKnife is it's watching the target as it's moving. So every 30 or 60 seconds, it's taking what's called orthogonal pair kilovoltage x-rays. It's taking very low radiation x-rays at sort of an angle to one another, and it's watching little gold markers that have been implanted into the prostate move. And it's able to watch the prostate move in 6 degrees of rotation. So you're watching X, Y, Z, and roll, pitch, yaw. So really, every single aspect, every plane of a prostate or a target's motion, you're able to take account for, not just before the treatment, but during the entirety of the treatment. Hmm. And that precision, again, is it's about half a millimeter, so less than a strand of hair.
So let's just backtrack a tiny bit.
Sure.
Gold markers. What does that involve for the patient?
So in order to when we're treating different areas of the body, there are different requirements on the CyberKnife machine. Mm-hmm. So if we're treating a lesion in the brain, for instance, we don't need to guide the target, because the brain doesn't move independent of the skull. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you sort of hold me in a normal position and you're watching my skull move, my brain's not moving independent of that. Mm-hmm. We'll make a little mold of somebody's pelvis, but they're lying freely on what we call a couch. It's not very comfortable, but it's a hard surface. And they're in a large room. There's no claustrophobia. It's not like being in an MRI or anything like that. And this machine is moving around them. It doesn't know what a prostate looks like. So it watches your pelvis, but your prostate's moving sometimes independent of your pelvis. In order to harness the power of the machine for the prostate, we'll put little pieces of gold in the prostate. They're a few millimeters. They're little pieces that stay in you for life. They don't cause any issues. The analogy I'll give to the guys we treat, you know, think about having dental work done. You have a cavity filled. You don't know it's there. If somebody did an x-ray of your mouth, they may be able to see some of the scatter x-rays of that. that, but you don't even know it's there. In order to put it there, we have a procedure where we will place little gold markers, usually with a needle, into the prostate. It's a one-time procedure. They stay in guys for life, and that's the process of putting the gold markers in.
Okay. So the gold markers, and again, not to get too deep in the woods here, but there are two different kinds that I think are like one that looks like a grain of rice or is described that way, and there's another kind called an anchor that's sort of weird looking. And
that's good that you know. There are actually quite a few.
Yeah.
And just like Coke and Pepsi think they have the special sauce and everybody's got their own opinion, really the CyberKnife, when you treat with the bread and butter IMRT machines, it's sometimes helpful to still have gold markers, but the machines don't have requirements because it's still a human being on the other side who's lining things up and pressing the button. The CyberKnife still has human beings, highly skilled therapists who are there, but the machine, since it's automatically taking into account motion, has a lot of requirements on how we place those gold markers. So we spend a lot of time on it. We actually conduct a lot of research on it. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different markers that one can use. We have our manufacturer that we sort of prefer to use, but if you go to CyberKnife centers anywhere in the country, they're going to use their own manufacturers, and that's all fine.
Okay.
As long as they're placing them in sort of a certain manner that it needs to be done in.
So it's not like really a patient choice, or I mean, it's
to have the gold markers.
No, a particular kind or whatever.
No. I joke around with guys. I'll say we're going to make your prostate worth a little bit more money today. Yeah. You know, some sort of schlocky humor like that. But
Actually, how much are they? How much more is the prostate?
Well, they're 14 karat gold, and they're higher grade, carat, from what I'm told by the manufacturers, than jewelry. But I don't know how much.
Think how romantic it would be to have your partner's or child's name etched in one of
yours. We don't put too many. We only put four in.
Okay, but I mean, there's a side business.
Sure.
Yeah. The idea that you're tracking the prostate, but you're also radiating the seminal vesicles, aren't you?
If that's part of the target. So you don't always have to target the seminal vesicles. So in men who have low-risk prostate cancer, you really don't have to. The data is not compelling that there's an advantage. Usually when guys have a little bit more advanced cancer, you are aiming at some of the seminal vesicles. Everybody's seminal vesicles, for guys who don't know, seminal vesicles are the drainage part of the prostate. Some seminal vesicles look like, remember Wilfred Brimley, sort of big bushy mustache from Cocoon movie, or some look like Dolly. Everybody's seminal vesicles look quite different.
Okay.
And usually when you're aiming at that part of the prostate, they're just like the bunny ears on a rabbit. You're aiming at only 1 centimeter, 1.5 centimeter. You're aiming at a very small amount of them. You're not chasing them all the way down with the radiation.
Okay. And lymph nodes? Do you go after those?
It really depends. So when I see guys, it's not cookie cutter medicine. We spend a lot of time. So I'll spend usually about an hour or so with guys. Mm-hmm. When I see them for a new diagnosis of prostate cancer, we'll go through all the tests that they've had, and we'll explain to them what they're at a highest risk of the cancer spreading to. And based on the risk of cancer spread, it would dictate which areas we need to treat. So if a guy has a very low chance of having prostate cancer that has spread in his pelvic lymph nodes, I will not direct any radiation to his pelvic lymph nodes. If a guy has very aggressive disease where I know he has cancer in the lymph nodes, or he just has such aggressive disease that the probability is so exquisitely high, we will give him radiation to the lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. That's one of the advantages of the treatment we could give.
Now, African-American men present at a higher rate of advanced stage disease. And, you know, African-American men die at over 2 times the rate of Caucasian men from prostate cancer. Do you put a sort of a heightened exigency or something on the African-American patients that do you see around staging?
So Do I counsel them differently?
Yeah.
I look at risk factors for people who might have a more aggressive variant. I don't deny, it's a question that gets asked, should African-American men not have active surveillance as one of the options? Mm-hmm. So you see a gentleman who's African-American, he has Gleason 6, not aggressive. He has cancer you can't feel on a physical exam. He has a PSA that's very low, plus or minus any of these other tests. Is it wrong to offer that man active surveillance? Based on the preponderance of data that we have and people really studying this, it's not wrong. You can offer that man active surveillance such that it's active. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of thoughts on why African-American men have higher rates of prostate cancer. Nobody knows. And a lot of people have looked at this. So they've asked, is there something genetically different? So maybe there's something genetically different about African-American prostate, gentlemen's prostate cancer, and that's why it's more advanced by the time it's discovered. There's a question of socioeconomic factors. So perhaps those are gentlemen who don't get screened as often with PSA tests. Mm-hmm. There's a question of that I find very interesting. Perhaps men of different ethnicities, the cancer can be located in different areas. So there's one theory that African-American men, their cancers may be more sort of higher up in the prostate where biopsies may not touch that cancer,
right,
where they never were diagnosed.
Yeah.
These are all competing theories. Nobody has the answer.
Yeah.
But obviously it gets played into sort of the that whole Rube Goldberg thought process of how to counsel somebody appropriately.
Yeah. Let's now talk about the advance around dosing. I mean, and to my mind, it's the question really is external beam radiation. You show up for 35 to 40 times, 5 times a week, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. CyberKnife is just 5 times.
Sure.
Tell me about this.
So with conventional radiation, remember what I mentioned, one of the weaknesses is that you have a target that's moving, but you don't see it move during the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So with conventional radiation, the design is that you're going to treat a broader area where more of the bladder and more of the rectum is in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things we talked about was how do you preferentially damage cancer and not normal tissue?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways you do that is it's a concept from the 1960s. It's called fractionation. So divide your radiation into tiny little pieces to let your body heal in between each fraction. So that concept is a very old one. And it's in the field of radiobiology. The question is, what if you now have precision? Now you're not in the black box sort of in an area, but you see the target and you see it dynamically as it's moving through every single plane. And so you're going to treat some bladder and rectum, but a much, much smaller volume. Can you up the dose a little bit? And so prostate cancer has a unique biology where it's more sensitive when you give it larger doses per treatment. That's a little bit unique in the world of cancer. And so with technology and that radiobiology aspect, if you give a prostate cancer a larger dose, you actually can have a much more effective treatment. So coupled with the technology, you're able to give 5 treatments with a higher dose per treatment, and you're actually giving the gentleman's cancer a much higher dose, and you're giving the normal tissue a much lower dose. There's a whole sort of algorithm on that. It's called biologic effective dose. If you look online at BED or biologic effective dose, it's going to go into a lot of radiation biology and concepts called alpha and beta and ratios, you know, people have spent entire careers on this.
Mm-hmm.
But suffice to say, the data is pretty compelling, and you now have data that goes out over well over a decade showing how effective it is when you're giving higher doses per treatment.
So patients were told 15 years ago that you're going to have 40 doses because each day, you know, your body will sort of have an incremental effect that the next day's dose will work on and work on and work on. You're saying now that we know differently, that a larger dose within a 5 day, 5 times within a week, is actually more effective long term.
So it's not the concept of the cancer so much as the normal tissue. So the reason that radiation historically has been fractionated is the concept of repair. Let your normal tissue repair itself in between each treatment.
Hmm.
It was always known that prostate cancer had this lower alpha beta ratio, and people would theorize and say, well, perhaps perhaps if I had the technology to more precisely deliver that large dose, it'll be effective. And in fact, 30 years ago, people were doing what's called high dose rate brachytherapy, where they were putting catheters inside of people and delivering the same doses that we're actually delivering today, but without radioactive material inserted.
One of MailCare's early supporters, Andy Grove from Intel Corporation, had high dose rate brachytherapy.
Sure. Yeah. So the doses that are now being harnessed on a robotic machine, the dose is the dose, as my partner John Haas always says. And I like that expression because it's true that the CyberKnife doses that we're giving, it's not new. They've been around for, you know, decades. They've been around for 30 years. The same way Da Vinci robotic surgery, well, that's only been prime time for 12 years.
Yeah.
But the concept of the prostatectomy has been around since 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just extrapolating on a technology, on something that didn't have the same technological advantage years ago.
Well, it's also different in the sense, I mean, the Da Vinci surgery isn't having an added value around how it's removing the prostate. It's just a different way to remove it.
Well, with all that surgery, I would disagree with you.
Well,
I'm not a robotic surgeon, but a robotic surgeon would say you have much shorter recovery time. I'm cutting less tissue.
But in terms of the effectiveness of I mean, the prostate's out.
Right.
Whether you had it done, you know, or however you pull it out, it's out. With dose delivery, understanding the higher quality and a more precise way of doing dose delivery, and doing it in a higher rate,
right,
within a shorter period of time, you have a different kind of long-term effect than you would at the 40 fractions.
Yes.
And that's an added value that the precision of using a robotic arm offers the patient.
Yes.
And that, to me, is exciting.
It's very exciting. Absolutely. It's what I spend all my time, you know, working on, counseling patients on, studying.
You see, I don't, but I mean, it's still exciting to me.
I think it's amazing.
The idea that it's five times. So if five times is an advantage, why not three times?
It's a great question. Yeah. So that's part of what, remember when you asked me, what's on the forefront? What are people looking at? People are mixing up the fractionations, but they're studying it. Nobody wants to be the guinea pig.
Hmm.
So we know it's safe to give this dose. So in our own institution, we've treated more than any place in the country. We treat over 4,000 men with this type of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And we know it's safe because we follow men. We have our own database. Other institutions internationally have used doses like this.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are now building protocols, and that's what's exciting. Can we do it in four doses, three doses, one dose, two dose? It's all about trying to figure out how to optimally treat the cancer, cure people, and minimize long-term side effects. A lot of the concept of, so we talk about the classical way with radiation is this long protracted course of treatment. So usually with prostate cancer, for instance, it's 9 weeks, 45 treatments or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Breast cancer, traditionally, it's this long course also. A lot of the changes in that conception had to do with access to care. So it had to do with folks in England and in Canada who had very sophisticated radiation units, but nowhere near what they had in the States, saying, you know what, in the interest of cost-effective medicine and access to care, can we get equivalent outcomes by truncating this treatment just a little bit? And especially as the technology gets better, let's keep truncating it a little bit more and more. That's called hypofractionation, and it's very much prime time. It's a standard of care,
mm-hmm.
and really the impetus behind it was simply access to care.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that spectrum, as you were saying, and you move it further and further, there are places, obviously, where you don't have the ability to have a radiation center, you know, every other block, and have all the sophisticated technology. And there's a true advantage to being able to treat people with who are traveling distances, have poor access to care, with larger doses per treatment if it can be safely done.
Sure.
So absolutely.
When you do surgery, you pull out the prostate, presumably, you know, assuming there's no mets or it's gone to lymph or whatever. You know, I mean, you've got everything. Presumably, you know, it hasn't been released or whatever. With radiation, with CyberKnife, is everything, can you
reasonably, like within the high 90s, tell the patient, I killed every one of your cancer cells?
Yes. So the issue at play is that there's a psychological thing that men go through when they have cancer. And it's not unique to men. It's women have it too. Anybody, where I have it, I got to get it out. Mm-hmm. And so there are men who are, they are exasperated when they have surgery and the cancer comes back. And that concept, how did the cancer come back? It's lost on them a little bit sometimes. So the issue is, there's the cancer we know about and the cancer we don't know about. Mm-hmm. So we have amazing technology in the year 2018. You have very sophisticated MRIs. You have really good CAT scans, really good ultrasounds. Biopsies are getting better. Genetic tests, you know, all this information. I said the three blind men, the elephant. We're really able to see what that elephant looks like much better mm-hmm. each year. The issue at play is there's always a chance that there could be microscopic disease we do not know about. So the advantage of surgery, so I never bash surgery. I work with the surgeons with whom I collaborate. I don't try to compete with them. Mm-hmm. So I think surgery is an amazing treatment and it's got some advantages. With surgery, you're cutting through the base of the bladder. You're cutting through the urethra, the tube that connects the bladder to the end of the penis. You're taking the prostate out and reattaching things. Mm-hmm. So the benefits of surgery is any disease that is housed in the prostate, you are removing it. Mm-hmm. So you're not relying on that cancer to die off. You're simply taking it out. So that's why if a guy has low-risk prostate cancer, his chance of cure is very high. And if a guy has aggressive prostate cancer, his chance is going to be lower. The issue at play is there could be microscopic disease that's just outside the prostate, microscopic disease that went into the seminal vesicles, microscopic disease that could be in the lymph nodes, wherever it is. With radiation, the relative value is that you're treating a small cocoon of energy that surrounds the prostate. So the competitive advantage of surgery is I'm removing your entire prostate with the cancer in it. Mm-hmm. The competitive advantage of radiation is the cancer inside is dying off, but I'm also providing a cocoon of a few millimeters outside of that area, where if you do have a risk of extracapsular disease, microscopic disease that no MRI, CAT scan, PET scan, bone scan could ever see, mm-hmm. you're actually accounting for that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was in Forbes magazine arguing with a surgeon over saying, let's spar over the low risk guys. Mm-hmm. If we were to compete, let's have sort of a friendly discourse over low risk patients competing against killing off the cancer or removing it all. Mm-hmm. Let's not compete with the high risk guys, because in my opinion, radiation has a clear advantage mm-hmm. in those cases. A clear advantage is that you're bathing tissues that have a high risk of microscopic disease, where a surgeon, it's not like the liver that you were mentioning, a liver study. Liver's a huge organ. You could cut very wide margins around a tumor, so if there's microscopic disease, you account for it. With the prostate, it's connected to the bladder. The rectum's right there. The nerves that control erections are on the sides. You can't cut a huge swath of normal tissue around.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of an unfair advantage that radiation has over surgery, and I'm very candid with patients about that. And the unfair advantage is with surgery, usually you know the erections have gone down because the mechanism is you cut the nerves that control erections. It's like cutting the wire in the ceiling. Light goes out. Sometimes guys will get a little benefit over time, but usually you know pretty early on if there's damage that's been born. Mm-hmm. The unfair advantage radiation has, and it is unfair from a purist standpoint, but it is what it is oftentimes it takes time to watch erections go down after radiation. Mm-hmm. So what's unfair about that is think about every single man or woman who's watching this right now or thinking about this. If that guy graded or his significant other graded that man's erections compared to what they used to be 5 years ago, 10 years ago, as we get older, there's a natural process of decline in erectile function for most guys. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's hard to tease out sort of that data, but we have data. So when I see men, I will counsel them on the rate of erectile dysfunction. I'll tell them what we try to do differently to limit that dysfunction. And again, it's not cookie cutter, but we really customize quite a bit the care to try to minimize that.
Right. And the idea of length and shrinkage. That's usually a question.
Of the penis.
Yeah. Surgery patients, almost, I mean, 9 out of 10 surgery patients will bring that up in a support group setting. I used to have a giant and now I'm a dwarf or whatever. You know, I mean, does radiation impact length?
No. Okay. So radiation does not. If you utilize something called hormone therapy, which is essentially chemically castrating somebody for a period of time, that may decrease some of the length of the penis. Okay. But in general, the radiation does not affect penis size.
In 60 seconds or less, what is it about radiation that impacts erectile function?
There's actually debates on that. So there are probably three different ways that people theorize that erections can get damaged over time by radiation. And it's why people like myself and physicians who are paying a lot of attention and designing radiation, they try to limit dose to these areas. One is to blood vessels. Just so why do men have decreased erections over time, just as we get older? Well, some of it is that nerves don't work as well. Some is that you get hardening of the arteries. So why do people with diabetes have worse erections or people with blood pressure issues? So one of the areas could be blood vessels. One of the areas could be just the neurovascular bundles themselves. So we know that's the mechanism with surgery. So if a surgeon cuts through those nerves, that's it. The erection's going to go. That said, even when a surgeon spares the nerves, erections go down. So there may be another mechanism of that happening. The last, which is classically thought of in the world of radiation, is that there may be some dose to the base of the penis called the penile bulb. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, people like me, when we study, remember I mentioned the first advantage of the CyberKnife was the non-coplanar aspect. The beam's coming from all over, the dose getting sort of a tighter shell. When I look at the penile bulb doses of the men I'm treating, it is an order of magnitude lower than when I used to use IMRT. Mm-hmm. So that is demonstrable, and it's because the doses are getting packed together. Mm-hmm. Can I prove that that's the reason why the erectile function tends to be very good in the guys we treat? I can't. Mm-hmm. And all treatment has a chance of erections going down. So I never sugarcoat that for guys. I'll always tell them, if you see a doctor who tells you erections don't go down or not in my hands or I could give a cadaver an erection or any of these sort of expressions, you should run. That's not an honest doctor.
Right.
But we can quantify to what degree erections go down.
And when you say a doctor says erections won't go down in my hands, of course, that does another thing. So the idea of ejaculate, that's gone with radiation.
That should be gone for the most part. So with surgery, you're really not going to have any ejaculate. Mm. With radiation, the vast majority of the ejaculate goes down. I do see guys who say, well, I have a little ejaculate. You have other sort of structures in that area. Mm. But in general, your ejaculate does go down.
Okay. So sperm banking before radiation therapy.
I think it's important. So I ask guys, and that's part of, I use the word, I've been humbled. I've been humbled not just with cancer outcomes and, you know, in general, but also everybody has their own preference. So I saw a gentleman in his late 70s the other day who wants to bank his sperm. Mm-hmm. So I actually ask every one of my patients, are you planning on having children at some point? What's interesting is that the radiation does not affect the testicles. So again, that benefit of the CyberKnife, I'm in the process of writing a manuscript and I've presented this at a national meeting. The dose we give to the testicles, which produce sperm, is actually lower with this treatment than any other form of radiation. Mm. So you still make sperm, but the ejaculate, which is the transit system for the sperm, that will go down.
Okay.
So it's more challenging to have children. There are guys I've treated who have said, I get it, I'm whatever, and they've impregnated their significant other. So it can happen, just the chance of that's very low.
Okay.
If you look at the data that's been published, there are rates that go out there with incontinence with surgery. There's a large one, a large study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine called the PIVOT trial, where men had 15-20% rates of needing pads or diapers or having that leakage.
Mm-hmm.
With modern day surgery, it could be lower than that, but that's sort of incontinence in general. With radiation, whether CyberKnife or any of the other types, there's always a chance of that, but it's very low. So when I see guys and they'll say, well, what's the rate that I'm going to have incontinence? I'll say, the way that you're thinking, the stress incontinence where you lift something heavy, cough or sneeze, and it comes out, you can't control it, that's going to be less than 1% for most guys. What radiation does cause is irritation. So men will urinate more frequently and more urgently. Guys don't think of that as incontinence, but there's a medical term called urge incontinence, which means I control my urine, I do not wear diapers, I don't wear pads, but if I have to pee and I'm out near a restroom, I might have an accident. And certainly with radiation, that's something that can happen to guys, and that's part of what people like me do for a living. We don't just treat guys and try to cure them of the cancer. We try to handle side effects, so we'll put guys on anti-inflammatories or Flomax or other medications.
How long are they on the table?
So with the newer version of the CyberKnife, usually it's about a 20-minute treatment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's quicker, so I've treated guys in 14 minutes. I've treated guys where it takes longer, 25 minutes. On this newer version of the CyberKnife, which we have, it's, I'd say, on average about 20 minutes.
And are you physically there?
I am. So I'm pretty anal, as you might be able to tell. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there for every single treatment. So I'm part of the advisory board and the company that makes the CyberKnife, and I go to these meetings. And there's a wide variation on how often physicians are physically present and watching. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of physicians are there or should be there. We have therapists. So the machine's doing most of the heavy lifting. The machine is on, has the ability to watch and to move dynamically. We have amazing radiation therapists who are there on the machine and watching and calibrating. And I always check on a daily basis all the treatments.
Okay. And the treatment, it's not like you're sitting there with a joystick zapping. I mean, it's already pre-programmed.
It's pre-programmed. So as I mentioned, we have PhD level and master's level physicists. We have dosimetrists, which is a whole other field. We have people who put together the radiation plans. People like me, the doctors review them. Sometimes it's iterative, where I'll say, well, get the dose down lower here, or I like it, or improve the dose here. It's a process. We review it. There's a lot of sophistication in that. And then once the plan is ready and we think it's good, it goes to the machine, and the machine will deliver what we plan. That's what I meant by, in my opinion, one of the benefits of the CyberKnife is the map matches the territory. Mm-hmm. Right? So we plan something, and I have very high confidence that what we plan gets delivered. Whereas with other machines, you can have a really good map, but that's not always what gets delivered because it's not watching the prostate during the treatment.
Okay.
The scenario that that I would imagine that we're going to go from here, yeah, is what do you do when it's a lot of time? It's been 2 years. It's 3 years. Mm-hmm. PSA is going up. The first thing I want to know. So the classical way of looking at this was cancer treatment didn't work. That's it. And so guys will go on hormone therapy, and there are different ways of doing that. I think the correct way of handling that in the year 2018 is finding out where the cancer is. Because mm-hmm. where it is determines what I'm going to do. So what surgeons sometimes will say to patients is, and there's some media savvy surgeons who I've heard say something like this, is you should always do surgery because if your surgery doesn't work, we'll give you radiation afterwards. If your radiation doesn't work, I can't do surgery.
Yeah.
And I'll always tell patients that's only a half truth, unfortunately.
Right.
The half truth aspect is if the surgery doesn't work, my radiation field involves a lot of your bladder. Mm-hmm. So your side effects are going to be much higher, mm-hmm. although you can be cured, and I treat guys all the time. The other half truth is it is harder to do surgery after radiation, but you could do cryotherapy. You could do high frequency ultrasound therapy. You could do radioactive seeds. You can mix some of them. You actually have more salvage options after radiation than if you had surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is, where's the cancer coming from? If the cancer is coming from some area in the prostate where it didn't die off, well, then I will send a guy, when they're appropriately sort of selected, for focal freezing, cryotherapy, focal high-frequency ultrasound, HIFU. I'll send a guy for focal brachytherapy, or radioactive seeds, mm-hmm. and they're very high rates of salvage cure.
Mm-hmm.
If I find out that there's no cancer in the prostate, so we did the CyberKnife, guy has a rising PSA, but it's not from the prostate. It's that there was microscopic disease that probably always existed in the lymph nodes. Well, then I have to cross that bridge. And there are really high cure rates of doing of high dose radiation to lymph nodes, or if you're worried about a region, bathing the region in lymph nodes, or even doing surgery. You start getting into an area where the data is a little bit all over the place, and you really want smart people talking to each other. So usually in cases like those, I'll present it at a tumor board, or I'll speak with other doctors, and we come to a consensus. It really depends on where the cancer is. Mm. If it's in one lymph node, I'll use a CyberKnife. I'll blast that one lymph node. If it's in a number of lymph nodes, then we're talking about conventional radiation or surgery.
Can you also do a palliative care for distant bone mets?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the machine shines. I've treated some very prominent individuals who are in the public life who you would never even know, but they have metastatic prostate cancer. Cancer has spread where if it goes to the bone in the spine, they may have some dysfunction and you could ablate that tumor. Mm-hmm. And that guy can regain usage of his extremities or what have you. You could definitely treat it very well for distant areas.
Thank you. Dr. Blacksburg, thank you.
Thank you
You've
so much.
Exceedingly generous with your time and your knowledge. And I hope it's been useful for our viewers.
Thank you.
Come watch another show. Click subscribe, which I think is down there on YouTube. If not, you'll probably get an email for our next webcast. Thanks for watching. Bye.